and history a few months later. When Parche finally hit deep water, she could move ahead without obstacles. This 1,500-mile swim beneath the North Pole itself would be easy. Depths of 1,000 to 12,000 feet left plenty of room to maneuver beneath the most massive icebergs. After that, Parche again had to maneuver through a tapestry of marginal ice before finally breaking through to the Barents. Now it was time for the crew to begin readying the fish to drag along the sea bottom in search of communications cables. Given the surrounding terrain and the location of Soviet bases, it made sense that any underwater telephone cable would run from Murmansk and along the coast of the Kola Peninsula, which pointed down from the Arctic, forming the thumb of the glove-shaped piece of land that marked Sweden and Finland as its fingers. The cable would probably stretch about 250 miles east to the tip, before it took a 40-mile hop across what the Soviets called the throat of the White Sea and looped into the Severodvinsk shipyard. It made little sense to lay a tap in that bit of the White Sea, where boats moved continuously from the shipyard out to the Barents. Instead, Parche would look for the cable in an area where it might be a little easier for her to hover for a while and not be discovered, such as along the granite cliffs on the northernmost coast of the Kola, in that 250-mile run after Murmansk. The search inevitably would bring Parche within the Soviets' 12-mile territorial limit, and probably even inside the 3-mile limit recognized by the United States. As Parche searched, men monitored the video images captured by the fish, looking for that vague line in the sand that could be a communications cable. They found it just about where operation planners had suspected it would be, farther out than 12 miles at some points, but a lot closer in at others. It was clear that this cable had to run from Severodvinsk to the major bases of the Northern Fleet, and on into fleet headquarters near Murmansk. Finally, Maurer picked a spot for the tap. In Okhotsk, the cable stretched across an entire sea, and Halibut had been able to plant that tap about 40 miles offshore. It is not clear exactly how far from the coast this tap site was, but it clearly was a lot closer in than the Okhotsk tap had been. Sonar crews monitored the constant traffic above as Parche's divers began their work. The water was deeper here than in Okhotsk. Divers were now working at least 500 feet under. On later missions to the Barents, some of the divers would work 600 feet deep as the tap was repositioned. Still, nothing but luck could keep Parche safe from a direct hit by a Soviet sonar ping. Standing in the control room, it seemed to the men that they could count the turn count of the propeller blades as Soviet destroyers and cruisers moved overhead in a near constant march in and out of port. The contacts caught by Parche's sonar were played over a speaker in her con, and it was here that the men were most acutely aware of the 150 pounds of HBX explosives on board, those self-destruct charges that had become required equipment on cable-tapping subs. The spooks were crammed into a tiny compartment just to the port side behind the torpedo room. Directly below, an auxiliary ballast tank had been emptied and transformed into storage space for the huge reels of tape and for spare parts. The tank was so cold that any tapes retrieved had to sit for 12 hours before they came back to room temperature and could be used. While Halibut had the Bat Cave, Parche had no more space than any other late-generation Sturgeon sub. In fact, most of Parche's torpedoes had been ditched for space. Now she carried just 4 live warshots, the minimum number any attack sub was allowed to carry on a mission. It would take the spooks at least 2 weeks to sift electronically through the hundreds of lines running through the cable and choose which lines to record and at what times over the next year. The process relied on educated guesses and luck. Certain channels would probably be best in the summer months when the ice cleared from the Barents and the Soviets conducted naval exercises. Missile tests tended to be seasonal as well, but lines connected directly to headquarters could be active and profitably tapped year-round. A few of the lines were unencoded or rang clear because whatever encryption the Soviets had tried to use had failed. Most, however, were encrypted to some degree. The NSA wanted even those lines that seemed burdened by the heaviest encryption, the lines that might have been hardest to decode. Intelligence analysts had learned from the first taps that those deeply scrambled lines were often running fleet to fleet, admiral to admiral, carrying crucial information. It also helped that the tap had evolved over the years. It weighed several tons, but miniaturization of the electronics and advances in recording technology now provided a greater recording capacity and some room for error. The CIA also adapted the miniaturized recording technology in the cable tap pods for land use and bribed a Russian construction worker to implant one against an important underground telephone cable in Moscow itself. Intelligence officials say this prized source of high-level communications was compromised in the mid-1980s by Aldrich Ames, the worst turncoat in CIA history. As all this was going on, a steady stream of Soviet ships and submarines continued to fill Parchi's sonar screens. The activity got the crew members to talking. One man whispered that Parchi was very, very near Murmansk, and really up against the Soviet coast. One chief found a more colorful way of describing their position to a young seaman. "This is so close you could look through a periscope and see people's faces on the beach if you came to the surface." As they sat there, some of the men began to realize that no one had ever leveled with them about the dangers of this operation. As one man put it, "Here you've got 100-some-odd guys willing to die, and they don't even know they're truly in a situation where they might." Finally, the job was done. All Maurer had to do now was get his men out of there and get them home. The plan was to leave the immediate area of the tap and signal "Mission accomplished" to a second U.S. submarine, which had been skulking nearby throughout Parchi's operation. Had there been any indication that Parchi was detected, it would have been this second sub's job to make a racket, become a decoy, and draw the heat. Parchi, of course, was maintaining strict radio silence, but she had been equipped with a special horn to send her signal. U.S. subs usually were wired for 60 kilohertz, but Parchi would signal at 50 kilohertz, the Soviet standard. To the Soviets, it was hoped the signal would sound like one of their own. To the men on board, the blast sounded like bongo drums. One quick beat on the bongos, and the message was sent. Parchi waited for a reply, then headed for home. For her feat, Parchi received the Presidential Unit Citation, the highest award possible. Each man was given a certificate with the presidential seal at the top and Jimmy Carter's signature on the bottom. It was an award that Halibut had won twice. Seawolf, never. By virtue of the authority vested in me as President of the United States and as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, I have today awarded the Presidential Unit Citation, Navy, for extraordinary heroism to USS Parchi, SSN 683, for extraordinary heroism and outstanding performance in the conduct of a mission of vital importance to the national security of the United States as a unit of the U.S. Pacific Fleet in 1979. The award read, Buried in the bureaucraties that followed was one telling line. It praised Parchi for operating in the hostile environment of poorly charted ocean areas. In 1980, Parchi was scheduled to go back to the Barents Tap, and Seawolf was scheduled to return to Okhotsk. But in February, a fire broke out on Seawolf during sea trials. A turbine generator blew up and began tossing balls of flame into the engine room while the sub was submerged. By the time Seawolf's crew could perform an emergency blow and surface, 10 men had been overcome by black, thick smoke. They were carried up to the deck and fresh air, and it was there they were photographed by a passerby. Instead of having a chance to win a PUC, to show the guys on Parchi that Seawolf's men were just as good, they were awarded with a page-one photo in a local newspaper captioned, "Seawolf Sons Basking in the Sun After Rigorous Sea Trials." Seawolf went back to dry dock for another year, and Parchi again took her place on a run to Okhotsk in the summer. Parchi also went back to the Barents that fall to plant a new tap and retrieve the first year's worth of recordings. By now, Ronald Reagan was scoring big in the presidential campaign. Carter had been plagued by the hostage crisis in Iran. He also was hurt by the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which killed any chance for ratification of the arms treaty he had just reached with Brezhnev. Both of these events also led the U.S. sub-force to step up surveillance of Soviet naval forces in the Indian Ocean. Reagan was promising to get tough with the Soviets. To that end, he pledged to pour billions of dollars into rebuilding the military, and he put the Navy front and center in his plans. Painting the conventional picture of the Soviet Navy as increasingly bent on challenging the West in any sea, pretty much the opposite of what Haver believed might be happening when he briefed Carter, Reagan said he would expand the U.S. Navy to 600 ships from 450 ships to prevent the Soviets from snatching maritime superiority. In fact, the Soviet fleet was growing. In November, a U.S. satellite captured images of an enormous pile of steel and a newly enlarged dock at a Soviet shipyard. That and other evidence suggested that the Soviets might be building their first full-sized aircraft carrier. To many top Navy officials, the satellite images seemed to be proof that Rich Haver and other young analysts were wrong about the Soviet Navy pulling back, and that in fact the Soviets were still gearing up for battle in the open oceans. They might finally be ready to pour money into the kind of huge surface ships and supply vessels that they would need to create a true blue water navy. After all, aircraft carriers had always been used to project power outward, to sail to distant places and launch planes. After his election, Reagan appointed John F. Lehman, Jr., the campaign aide who had come up with the plan for the 600-ship fleet, as his Navy secretary. At only 38 years old, Lehman was the youngest man in this century to hold the post. He was smart, quick, and outspoken about his hard-lined stance. "I believe that our former narrow margin of superiority is gone," Lehman warned Congress on February 6, 1981, just one day after he was sworn in. It didn't take long for him to earn a reputation as l'enfant terrible, as he took control of the Navy in a way that no secretary had attempted in decades. Lehman's plans included a radically new and aggressive naval strategy. He didn't talk much about what he expected the Soviets to do in a war. Instead, he wanted U.S. submarines, battleships, cruisers, and aircraft carriers to drive en masse right into the Barents and go after the Soviet surface and submarine fleets in their own waters. He was making, he declared, a firm commitment to go into the highest threat areas and defeat the Soviet naval threat. Lehman became fond of describing Murmansk and the rest of the Kola Peninsula as the most valuable piece of real estate on earth. Soon, top admirals were grumbling that Lehman was a torpedo without a guidance system. Most liked his idea of a more aggressive strategy, but Lehman dismissed out of hand the protests of some admirals that it was suicide to drive aircraft carriers into the Barents, where the Soviets could easily sink them with cruise missiles. He also shrugged off outside critics, academics and congressional staff members among them, who warned that threatening Soviet sea-based missiles too early in a war could backfire, prompting them to use 'em or lose 'em. This was the backdrop as Pentagon officials prepared to give Reagan his first briefing about submarine spy operations. It was scheduled for Friday, March 6th at 9:15 a.m., and was set to run 20 minutes. The luminaries who gathered in the wood-paneled Situation Room in the West Wing of the White House included Vice President George Bush, Chief of Staff James A. Baker III, Counselor Edwin Meese II, and Richard V. Allen, the new National Security Advisor. Attending from the Pentagon were Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, Admiral James D. Watkins, the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, Lehman, Haver, and Rear Admiral John L. Butts, now Director of Naval Intelligence. Weinberger and Watkins got things rolling by sketching the basics of the surveillance missions being run by regular attack subs. Then Butts stepped in to introduce Reagan to Seawolf, Parchy, and cable tapping. He made his presentation with a dramatic video and slideshow that Lehman had told him would appeal to Reagan. The president was, by all reports, mesmerized. Finally, he leaned over and asked his vice president, a former director of Central Intelligence, "Did you have something to do with this, George?" Bush answered that some of these programs had run during his tenure at the CIA. Then Rich Haver stepped in and, just as he had with Carter, began to describe how naval intelligence used the information the spy subs were collecting. Haver had slides, too, but by now Reagan was itching for answers. He wanted to know if Haver thought the Soviets would be less willing to wage nuclear war now that they were facing him and his hard line in the White House. He also asked some of the same questions the analysts had been grappling with. How do the Soviets plan nuclear war? How do they train for it? How do they intend to fight it? Would a naval war go nuclear from day one, with Soviets using cruise missiles against aircraft carriers? And if it did, could it be contained at sea before anyone fired strategic ballistic missiles at the United States? Again, Haver succeeded in drawing a president into a dialogue. In a question-and-answer session that went on for nearly 15 minutes, with Bush and Watkins fielding questions also, Haver explained the conventional view of war on the high seas and the long-held assumption that the Soviets would probably turn to tactical, short-range nukes early in those battles. He added that such a move had seemed likely to set off a broader nuclear war. Then he offered some of the conclusions that his team of analysts had reached, that the Soviets appeared to be turning away from the conventional strategy and dedicating the bulk of their ships, attack subs and planes, to protecting their missile subs in safe bastions close to home. From here, Haver went on to plug Lehman's aggressive plan to confront those forces in Soviet waters. When Reagan seemed satisfied, Haver began to pack up the projector, as Weinberger stepped in to carefully explain to the president what his role in the process would be, how he needed to sign off on all the sensitive espionage operations in advance. Weinberger took his time, talking slowly and very deliberately. He wanted to make sure that Reagan appreciated what was being asked of him. Weinberger needn't have worried. Reagan was already hooked. Nobody had told him any of this when he was merely governor of California, home to the nation's most crucial spy subs. He had come to Washington still holding onto a view of the Navy built from equal parts of World War II fact and of World War II myth, the image of heroic men facing off against Japanese ships, their torpedoes sinking the enemy, dodging depth charges as they went along. This was an image dear to Reagan, and he loved to talk about how he played a submarine captain in the 1958 film Hellcats of the Navy. Reagan had a favorite story about those days, and he told it now, albeit with only the details fit for screen. In Reagan's version, he effortlessly echoed commands whispered by a Navy officer, and with cameras rolling, set one of the nation's subs steaming out of San Diego in a Pacific sunset. Reagan's tale was missing some rather pertinent facts. What actually happened was that he virtually brought the house down, though not by virtue of his acting. The crew, told to treat Reagan's orders as they would their captain's, accidentally overheard the actor practicing his lines, and they responded. "Answer all bells," he said, giving the code for get underway, practicing to get just the right inflection. "All back full. All ahead two-thirds. Starboard stop. Starboard ahead standard. Left full rudder." The submarine began to jerk in every direction. Back, forward, stopped, forward, left. The bow lines began to stretch, then pull until the aging pier that had moored the sub snapped into pieces of cracked wood and rusted iron, just as the sub's captain raced to the bridge, yelling, "All stop, for God's sake, all stop!" As Bush and Baker began trying to hustle Reagan along, the president was still talking about his experiences on the Hellcats set and his admiration for the submariners he met there. This briefing had already gone on for 45 minutes, more than twice as long as it had been scheduled to run. Reagan, however, was in no rush. Turning to Haver, the president asked, "Where do you get guys like this?" "Sir, they're just Americans," Haver answered in his best for the Gipper style. On that note, Reagan finally seemed ready to leave. It was clear he wanted Haver to keep trying to puzzle out Soviet strategy, and that he had given his tacit approval for the next round of submarine spying missions. All this occurred as Seawolf was ready to go to sea again. For the first time, the Navy could send both Special Projects boats out at the same time, in different directions, to different seas. Before Parchee could leave for her 1981 run, however, Commander Peter John Grafe, her new captain, ordered what he thought would be a routine drug screening. The last thing he expected was to nail nearly 15% of his crew for marijuana use, 22 crew members, including three officers. There was no debate. They were off the boat, and replacements were rushed in. This was definitely not what Reagan had in mind during the briefing when he had asked Rich Haver where the Navy found these guys, these superheroes of the Cold War. Although, in retrospect, Haver's answer seemed far less corny. They were just Americans, after all. Staffing these boats had never been easy. Navy recruiters went through bizarre contortions to keep their secret, and at the same time find men who wouldn't mind trespassing in Soviet seas for the purpose of cable tapping. As one young submariner described it, the recruitment process was more like an interrogation. Men in leisure suits brought potential projects men into smoky rooms, and then began demanding to know, did the recruit ever use drugs? Ever get in trouble with the law? The questions were peppered with promises that the government had ways of learning every dirty detail. "If you ever jacked off behind the barn, we will find out about it," one kid was told. Parchee wasn't unique in her personnel problems, and the drug bust had intelligence officials worried. Seawolf's crew was disintegrating under the mounting frustrations of serving on a broken-down and cursed boat. The pressure inspired some of her crew to lose themselves in a marijuana haze. Some even proclaimed their drug use openly and loudly, just to get off of Seawolf. Then there were Seawolf's isolationists, who were readying for the day when they would take singular stands against communism in mountaintop homes transformed into forts. These men had taken to going out to the mudflats near the base to practice with their non-Navy-issue assault rifles, blasting apart cans and at least one truck. One man sent a live round into his television. The rest of the crew, leery, sweaty, and exhausted, just looked on at the dopers and the gun fanatics. Such tensions remained as Seawolf finally headed out toward Okhotsk. By now, Michael C. Tiernan had been the CO through 3 years of overhaul and tests. This was to be the first time he commanded the boat through an actual operation. A Seawolf crew that had once compared his predecessor, Charles R. McVean, to Captain James T. Kirk on the Starship Enterprise, now nicknamed Tiernan Milktoast. The men had tried to take him out to the horse and cow to loosen him up, but they didn't think it had helped. Tiernan, in fact, was only slightly more popular than his new executive officer, J. Ashton Dare, whom the men referred to as Jashton. If the men found Tiernan aloof, they found Jashton downright irritating. His father was an admiral, and it seemed to the men that he wasn't going to let anyone forget that. Worse for Jashton, he had replaced a crew favorite, Robert S. Holbrook, an officer who could chastise a man in the morning and redeem himself later that night by taking him out for a beer. Holbrook also had been the crew's good luck charm. He had already survived an 85-degree dive on the diesel sub USS Chopper, SS-342, saved only when an enlisted man thought to throw her into reverse, driving her back up toward the surface. Thereafter, Holbrook always wore a brass belt buckle adorned with Chopper's image, certain that it made him unsinkable. He had his men just as convinced. As far as they were concerned, Dare had neither the mythology nor the charm to redeem himself. He was their favorite target, as they looked for ways to fight boredom. On one test run, some of the men stole Dare's mattress and flushed it through the garbage chute and out of the boat. The XO somehow missed the joke. In fact, humor was more than a little strained on this boat full of men who felt they were being sent to Soviet waters in the equivalent of a Model T. By the time ice began forming on Seawolf's deck plates, morale was at an all-time low. Things only got worse on station. Tiernan directed his crew to plant the sub next to the Soviet cable. The plan was to let Seawolf sit secure on the bottom, balancing her bulk on two ski-like legs that the crew had taken to calling skegs. The skegs were a gift of imagination and technology, a safety device designed after that first terrible storm that had torn halibut from her anchors. But a Seawolf tried to land with those skegs now. She came down hard, right on the Soviet cable. There was every chance that the fall had interrupted Soviet communications or sent a shot of static through the line, and there was every chance that the Soviets would send surface ships blasting sonar or repair crews to come and investigate. But there was no sign of a Soviet search. By the time the tapping operation was completed, Tiernan decided to go ahead and finish a secondary operation. Seawolf was going to move further into Okhotsk, and she was going on another search for Soviet missile fragments. But just as it seemed certain that the Americans were going to survive their mistake, they came under assault, not from the Soviets, but from the sea itself. Twin storms that had started hundreds of miles away, their winds swirling, were nearing Okhotsk. Beneath the sea, Seawolf sat too deep to put up an antenna, and the crew was unaware of the warnings flooding the airwaves about the cyclones moving up toward the Kuril Islands. The men didn't hear when naval command centers reported winds of 55 knots and swells leaping toward the sky. They didn't know when other craft were warned that the two storms had become one, a single lethal typhoon. Within days of the first warnings, thrashed air, bullet rains, and massive waves were combining to force their wrath below the surface, pounding down until Seawolf began to shudder. At first, the men believed they could easily weather the squall. Unlike surface mariners, submarine crews are trained to fear detection, depth charges, and torpedoes. But there is usually little to fear from storms. Run deep. That was the standard procedure. Submariners are indoctrinated from the start with the faith that the skies could open up all they like, winds could gust, threatening all who skim the surface. But below, where dark and calm hold court, submarines reign. Indeed, the 400 feet of water overhead, though shallow by submarine standards, would have been enough to frustrate most storms. But this typhoon was roiling even the depths, and for Seawolf, there was no going deeper. She would have to weather this out on the seabed. Seawolf began rocking from side to side. Three divers were out, and they were being tossed. The rest of the crewmen, safer inside, were trying to act nonchalant, squeezing past one another within Seawolf's cramped corridors. They offered comments about the storm as if they were discussing the weather back home. Still, the currents that were hitting Seawolf every 20 or 30 seconds were so violent that her skegs were lifting from the seabed. At first, the submarine rolled only a few degrees, then more. Objects inside went flying. With the submarine on the bottom, nobody had thought to secure for heavy seas. Beauregard was knocked from his high perch in the torpedo room and fell to the deck with a resounding crash. For a moment, the torpedo men feared their mascot, their favorite ceramic frog, would be erased from their ranks in an instant. With great relief, they realized that only his stand was destroyed. Outside the boat, the divers were losing their fight against the pull of the currents. One diver was sucked toward the rocking submarine and found himself beneath one of Seawolf's skegs. Something grabbed hold of him an instant later. Another diver, a lash of the current. Just as this man was about to be pinned, he was free. Finally, the divers were able to scramble into the unsteady shelter of the submarine. That was what Tiernan was waiting for. He signaled the end of the operation. He wanted his submarine in deep water. He wanted out of Okhotsk. But Okhotsk was holding on. Buda, a reactor specialist who had earned his nickname for his size, and despite his thick thatch of black hair, signaled the first alarm. He had been standing at a gauge for one of the heat exchangers that cycled cooled water before it went into the submarine's nuclear reactor. The temperature was not reading anywhere near correct levels. Something was clogging the system. Checking valves, moving equipment, Buddha started yelling. "I've got sand in there! Jesus Christ!" The nukes, those men who worked the reactor, came running, followed by Dare and Tiernan. They stood looking at a pile of sand. Seawolf's vents were sucking in muck, salt, the sea, and the sea floor into the cooling system. The storm began taking on new and terrible significance as they realized that the reactor was in danger of shutting down. Seawolf was at risk of losing all power. Crewmen began checking other points where the submarine borrowed water from outside, cycled it through the boat, and cycled it back outside. Sand, little animals, snails, coral, and sea creatures had gotten into the generators, the main engines, the turbines, and the half-dozen or so critical areas on board. There were piles and heaps of the wet, partially living mass around the boat. No one was sure how much weight they had taken on, as the wet mass was sucked in from Okhotsk's bottom. Worse, the sand was coming in because the seawater intake valves that should have been several feet above sea bottom were resting practically flat against it. Each time the storm rocked Seawolf, a little more sand was pumped over the skegs. The currents were forcing the sub to dig herself in. Somehow the engineers who designed those skegs as safety devices had ignored the properties of currents that children learn about when they stand in the surf at the beach. Now Seawolf's skegs were almost entirely buried. She was stuck. Compartment by compartment, men began to fret. The machinist mates knew that if the steam plant shut down, it could take a week to restart, if it restarted at all. The nukes worried that with the sand damage, the reactor might not start back up. The Seawolf was just not strong enough for this kind of a test. No one, it seemed, was immune to the growing tension. An electrician's mate lost control and began yelling, screaming, crying. A medic was ordered to sedate him and send him to his rack. Others began to have chilling visions of blank epitaphs. Somewhere lies this seaman, sent to do something in an unknown place and killed, somehow, in a war that didn't exist. Seawolf was mired for nearly 2 days as the chiefs, the old salts who had ridden submarines for 20 years, joined forces with the junior officers. With Tiernan's approval, they began trying anything they could think of. First, they attempted to rev Seawolf's engines to see whether that would get her to pull up. That failed. Next, they tried a controlled emergency blow, hoping the sudden loss of weight would send them floating out of the sand. It was dangerous. Seawolf might pull free, but she might also broach the surface, and that could mean detection, and detection would mean a fight. Seawolf had few means of protection at her disposal. Most of her torpedo tubes had been used to store potatoes. There were still some torpedoes on board, but recent tests had proved them all but useless. Seawolf was the loudest thing in the water, so whenever she had launched a test dummy, its sonar guidance system turned the torpedo around and sent it hurtling back toward the sub. Seawolf's only chance was to remain hidden as she freed herself. Carefully, the crew began to blow ballast, slowly, steadily, gently, first from the bow, then from the stern. Nothing. "Try again," someone ordered tensely. A little more water this time, with the anchors down to prevent an accidental flight to the surface. Again, nothing. Another try, and the submarine seemed to move slightly, but only slightly. It was like trying to get a pickup truck out of a rut, rocking back and forth, hoping sooner or later to be able to push it out. But with sand still being sucked into the machinery, the men were in a race. Would they get out before their system shut down? All through the boat, men were trying to blow the sand out, but the submarine was sucking in more than they could discard. A key reactor system was already down to less than 50% efficiency, maybe as low as 35%. Somebody came up with the idea of cutting loose the anchors that were there to steady the Seawolf as she sat on her skegs. Anchors might save the sub from broaching, but right now, the two concrete mushrooms were also weighing her down. The order was given to cut them loose. Seawolf began to rise. The main engines were being badly overworked, revving until it sounded as though a drill was whirring through the boat. Then there was a scratchy sound, more of a shriek, really, loud enough that some of the men wondered whether their hearing would be forever affected. The skegs remained partially buried. The gondola under the Seawolf's belly, the huge clamshell that was built to hold missile pieces, partially ripped away. But Seawolf was free. As she limped home, she was dangerously loud in the water, louder than she had ever been. There was something dangling from below, a piece of skeg, the gondola. Whatever it was making a lot of noise in the water as Seawolf made a slow race for the Kuril Islands and out to open ocean. Crucial systems parts, worn down by sand, were also grinding and seemed ready to give out any moment. Then, somewhere in the Pacific, not far from Okhotsk, she was detected. A Soviet boat, probably a trawler, began pinging with active sonar. There was no way to outrun the trawler. The submarine was too hurt, and no way to hide, because whatever she was dragging banged against her hull even when she was sitting stock still. Any speeds faster than 6 knots brought a cacophony of sound, a drum section gone wild. The Soviet pings rang through the submarine, adding to the din. The ringing would not stop. The Soviets chased, giving up the pursuit after only about 24 hours, for reasons that may have been as simple as a trawler captain's whim. When Seawolf finally pulled into a closed dry dock, the men could see the damage. There were dents in her superstructure and pieces torn off as if she had suffered depth charges. The bilges were still full of sand, hundreds of pounds of it, though a significant amount had been moved to the men's bunks, jars of gray, grainy souvenirs. There were no awards given for this mission, no formal recognition of the men's brush with death. A cruise book, crafted much like a high school yearbook, mentioned the ordeal in only one cryptic cartoon, memorializing the first and last leap taken by Beauregard the Frog. Back in port, the men trying to repair Seawolf weren't told how sand got into the diesel engines, how it got into the lube oil system, and ate up all of the bearings. Officials in Washington had far more serious fears. Following Seawolf's misadventure, satellites uncovered evidence that the Soviets had found the cable tap in Okhotsk. Nobody was sure how, whether the operation had been compromised by Seawolf's drop onto the cable, or by a mole within the crew, or, unthinkable as it seemed, among the few intelligence officers who knew about the taps in the first place. But clearly it was crucial that someone discover how the Soviets had puzzled out one of the most secret U.S. missions. Chapter 11 The Crown Jewels. The feeling had to have been one of disbelief. Richhaver looked at the report on Seawolf's latest patrol, then at his other intelligence reports. There was just no other way to line up the facts. It had been easy to blame Seawolf and her crew for blowing one of the most important intelligence operations of the last 10 years. Or so it had seemed at the time. After all, Seawolf had slammed tons of steel down on the Soviet cable. That had to have caused a break in communications, or at least some static. Why else would the Soviets have sent a survey ship to Okhotsk? How else could they have found the cable tap? In fact, the Soviets did more than find the tap. They reached down and lifted the large recording pods, both of them, out of the water. There was no hiding what they were, or for that matter, who had put them there. Inside of one was a part emblazoned with the words, "Property of the United States Government." Haver had checked and rechecked his timelines. There could be no mistake. None of this was Seawolf's fault. The Soviet survey ship had been on its way to the area before Seawolf fell on the cable. It had taken a meandering route to Okhotsk, a trek that suggested camouflage, all the way from the Baltic Sea on the Atlantic side. There was, however, almost no chance that U.S. intelligence was going to miss a ship heading toward the tap site. Both in the Barents and in Okhotsk, the U.S. maintained around-the-clock surveillance with satellites, land listening stations, in short, any means possible. That was especially easy in Okhotsk. The sea was so empty, any ship that went in and loitered was bound to stand out. Now that surveillance had paid off, with one horrifying realization. The search for the taps almost had to have been deliberate. And if that were the case, Haver knew there was one glaring possibility, the worst possibility, that Seawolf hadn't shown her hand at all. The Soviets may have been tipped. There might very well be a spy. This was not going to go down well in the Navy or the NSA. That much was clear to Haver as he listed the spy among the reasons why the tap could have been discovered in a report dated January 30th, 1982, the day that just happened to be his 37th birthday. But while Haver expected distress, what he got back was outright skepticism. Top admirals decided he was seeing ghosts again, just as they had believed a few years earlier, when he had raised an alert about a possible spy or communications leak in the Atlantic. Now here he was seeing spies in the Pacific. What Haver was saying seemed unbelievable. If he was right, there was not one, but two spies. One man couldn't be responsible for the problems in both oceans. Anyone with operational knowledge of the Atlantic submarine trailings in the late 1970s was almost guaranteed to be out of the loop when it came to the Pacific tapping operations. Besides, the cable taps were about the best-kept secret in all of Cold War intelligence. No, top admirals concluded, Haver was seeing shadows in coincidences. The Soviets, they figured, had probably just found the Okhotsk tap on a maintenance run to the cable. Only a few in the Navy saw Haver's report, and they gave his warnings little thought. This was a time when the United States was facing a more immediate and tangible threat. The Soviets seemed to be engineering another big change in their missile sub strategy, one more dangerous than their move back to the bastions in the Barents in the late 1970s. They were now holding some of their missile subs even closer to their coasts, in deep bastions, such as the White Sea and the once nearly desolate Okhotsk, and they were hiding others under a nearly impenetrable shroud, the Arctic ice. Haver and other bright young analysts still felt sure that the Soviets were chiefly trying to protect their missile subs from attack in the early stages of a war, and the early returns from the cable tapping in the Barents seemed to back up this idea. But if they wanted to, the Soviets also could use the Arctic cover to launch a first strike, and the United States would have less warning than ever before. A missile shot from a delta in a Soviet bastion in the Barents could take less than 30 minutes to travel the 3,500 nautical miles to Washington, D.C. But a missile traveling from even the northern reaches of the Arctic's Baffin Bay, which sits just above Canada, could cut that time to less than 20 minutes. Naval intelligence began to notice that the Soviets seemed to be experimenting with the idea of hiding their missile subs under the ice in 1979. USS Gurnard, SSN 662, under the command of Henry G. Chiles, Jr., and USS Drum, SSN 677, helped set off a second and much more difficult era of trailings that year, following Soviet subs which seemed to be testing how well they could operate under ice floes. For the Soviets, a crucial moment came in the summer of 1981, when Captain Leonid Kuversky drove his Delta SSBN into the desolate Arctic Ocean to see if he could manage to rise up from the ice and calculate a workable trajectory for his sub's 16 ballistic missiles. Kuversky succeeded beyond all expectations. For his initiative and courage, he was named Hero of the Soviet Union, his nation's top honor. A gaggle of orders and medals went to his crew. The scientists and weapons designers who had traveled along received various state prizes in a ceremony that was held that October. Indeed, the Soviets' shift to the Arctic was a brilliant move. After all, it had never been lost on either side that the shortest distance between the United States and the Soviet Union was over the top of the world. Both nations had already aimed their huge arsenals of land-based missiles across the North Pole, But although both had been exploring the Arctic with submarines for decades, neither the United States nor the Soviet Union had been able to develop the technology to fight in the exotic Arctic environment effectively. The Arctic is also the one area of the world where the prey has the distinct advantage over the hunter, where it would be hugely difficult for U.S. forces to root out the Soviet missile subs and destroy them. For one thing, there are thousands of miles of shallow ice-filled seas where the Soviets could scatter their subs. Even the most massive boats could disappear in these shallows, drift silently along with the ice, and allow the currents to decide direction. And by taking the shallow route through the Kara Sea, the Laptev Sea, and the Beaufort Sea around the North American side, a Soviet sub could end up among the icebergs of Baffin Bay above Canada, the fjords along the west coast of Greenland, or even the channels that reach clear down to the Hudson Bay inside of Canada. A submarine hiding motionless would be almost silent, while any attack submarine seeking it out would become the loudest and best target around. U.S. scientists had tried for years, with only limited success, to devise sonar that could compensate for conditions in these marginal ice areas, where temperature and salinity layers, the din of near-constant storms, ice crunching upon ice, and the barks of seals and walruses combined to make tracking other subs nearly impossible. No wonder an alert ran through the Navy, over to the Pentagon, and into the Oval Office, when Soviet missile subs began slipping into the Arctic. At stake was nothing less than the ultimate nuclear advantage. And now the U.S. government needed to know. Was this simply another defensive move? A Soviet counterfeint in the game of deterrence? Or were the Soviets positioning for a possible first strike? Were Soviet leaders as insane and evil as President Ronald Reagan and his supporters were proclaiming? Or were the Soviets just afraid that Reagan was as hostile as his rhetoric? Adding to these fears was the fact that the Soviet Union was building a new and powerful generation of missile subs, the Typhoons. The first was already in sea trials, and satellites had caught sight of at least three more of the subs under construction at shipyard 402 in Severodvinsk. They were nuclear monsters, squat and bulbous, and by far the largest undersea craft constructed by any nation, half again as large as the Trident missile subs, which the United States had put to sea in late 1981. While both classes of submarines stretched almost as long as two football fields, the Typhoon was twice as wide as the Trident. The Soviets were also building four large underwater tunnels at a new submarine base at Gromyka, near the tip of the Kola Peninsula, about 150 miles from Murmansk. Blasted out of the adjacent hillside, the granite tunnels were large enough to accommodate the Typhoons, and seemed designed to give them protection from nuclear attack. That the Typhoons would be ice-ready seemed obvious. They were protected by two pressure hulls, within a third outer hull, and they had flat, retractable bow diving planes, a shielded propeller shaft, and a reinforced steel sail. Hiding in the Arctic, it would be easy enough for a Typhoon to push its massive bulk through ice cover several feet thick for an attack on the United States. A Typhoon could carry 20 SSN-20 nuclear missiles, each 50 feet long, and able to hold 10 warheads programmed to hit different targets as far as 4,500 nautical miles away. This was a boat built to survive, a boat built to ensure that in the event of nuclear war, key U.S. military centers and cities would not. The United States needed more than ever to divine the Soviets' intentions, to get right inside their minds. And that meant the cable-tapping operation had to continue, even though the Okhotsk tap had been discovered. Seawolf was too old and too broken to ever send back to the Soviet coast. Future missions would be left up to Parchy. Meanwhile, it would be up to the rest of the sub-force to keep learning about the technical capabilities of the Deltas and the Typhoons, to try to carry the crucial game of trailing to the Arctic, and to do something that had eluded the U.S. Navy for 40 years, develop a true Arctic capability. And so admirals turned again to one civilian scientist who had long insisted on studying those icy waters when few others in the Navy showed much interest. Waldo K. Lyon, the director of the Navy's Arctic Submarine Laboratory in San Diego. The Navy learned early on that Lyon's impish physical stature was hugely misleading, partially by sheer will, partially with his ability to enlist the support of at least one top admiral or CNO every year. Lyon had kept his lab alive and working to unearth the secrets of the Arctic ice since the end of World War II, when he had first become convinced that the Soviets would ultimately learn a lesson from the Nazi captains who had taken their U-boats under the ice's edge to target Allied supply ships. He had kept the lab running despite skepticism so fierce that the CNO handbook back in 1950 included the line, "It's fantasy to think about using the Arctic Ocean." Still, Lyon had won enough backing to inspire the sub-force to send at least one sub to the Arctic almost every year since Nautilus traveled beneath the North Pole in the late 1950s. Lyon had been up that way more than 20 times himself, and he or someone from his lab rode along on every one of those trips, helping to map routes under the ice and to experiment with different types of sonar. But it was only now, at 67 years old, that he was being called out of relative obscurity by a bunch of admirals who were suddenly terribly interested in the Arctic. Somebody suggested sending some of the older U.S. missile boats to hide under the ice, a seemingly perfect tit-for-tat. Rickover, on the verge of being forced to retire by Secretary of the Navy Lehman, came up with his own proposal to build an experimental Arctic sub, one with a hardened hull and little more than a hump for a sail. He had tried his usual tactics to push the project through, bypassing the Navy and the Pentagon, and sending Lyon and the proposal straight to the House Armed Services Committee. But all that ever came out of this effort was a letter to Lehman written by House staffers, who were stunned that nearly a quarter century of Arctic submarine expeditions hadn't left the United States ready to fight beneath the ice. Rickover had to let the fight die when Lehman finally forced him to retire at age 82 in January 1982. Several previous Defense and Navy secretaries had wanted to ease Rickover out, but his supporters in Congress and presidents like Carter had always stopped them. Reagan, however, stood firmly behind his Navy secretary. Even though Rickover appealed to the president forcefully in an Oval Office meeting, calling Lehman a pissant, and asking Reagan, "Are you a man? Can't you make decisions for yourself?" Rickover took some revenge by hanging in his retirement office a picture of Benedict Arnold next to a portrait of Lehman. Later, one admiral confided to Lyon that the Navy would never build an experimental Arctic sub, because doing so would show the Soviets that the U.S. Navy was unable to fight under the ice. Besides, a plan to develop an Arctic sub would compete with another proposal now before Congress. The Navy wanted funds to build a new class of super subs, one they were claiming could do just about anything. Some in the Navy were calling the boat Fat Albert. It was, in fact, the highly controversial Seawolf class of attack submarines, the SSN-21s, which were to follow the Los Angeles-class boats that were replacing the Sturgeon class. Looking on, naval intelligence also liked the idea of a new class of submarines. Intelligence officers figured that any new technology would give the Soviets another problem to solve, another distraction. Besides, the intelligence officers believed that by announcing plans to build new and better submarines, the United States would send the message that the Soviets would never have the edge, no matter what they did. All of this talk about new ice operations and new submarines helped distract attention from plans to send Parchi back out to the Barents. This trip worried planners more than the return to Okhotsk had. The Barents cable carried the most sensitive information, and even if the Soviets had found the tap in Okhotsk by accident, reason might have led them to at least keep tighter watch on the Barents, especially if they suspected another tap but had been unable to find one. The round-the-clock surveillance of the tap site hadn't shown anything unusual, but it was hard to know for sure. Okhotsk was desolate. Any activity was going to be pretty obvious. The waters of the Barents, on the other hand, were so active that a Soviet search for a second cable tap could have been camouflaged by the usual traffic. There was also the possibility, though most naval intelligence officers thought it a long shot, that Haver was right, that there was a spy. If that was the case, the Soviets might be keeping careful track of Parchi herself. They might even know that Parchi had invaded the Barents through the Arctic. But what if Parchi were sent by a different route, a very different route, one that could confuse any efforts at surveillance? The word was put out to the crew. Parchi was leaving earlier than usual, in April instead of late summer, and she was going to go south on an endurance mission, south past the equator, away from the Arctic, away from the Soviet Union. She would travel along the U.S. Pacific coast, past Central America, and down along South America to Cape Horn. What was held back was that Parchi would ultimately round the Cape and head back north through the Atlantic for the Barents. She would also have to swing wide of the Falkland Islands, where Britain and Argentina were at war. It was the most indirect route anyone could have thought of, save for a trip through Antarctica. It was a feint of masterful misdirection, and it would allow Parchi to avoid the heavy ice she would have encountered since she was leaving so early in the year. Parchi would have to travel more than 15,000 nautical miles each way, a round trip that would make the mission last nearly 5 months. She was to go entirely underwater. "They want to see how long we can last," the men began telling one another as they unknowingly repeated their own cover story. "We are going for a record." As Parchi was loaded for a possible 150 days at sea, so many cans of food were hoisted aboard that the men had to cover a toilet seat with a plank in order to transform one of the heads into a pantry. After that was filled to the ceiling, the upper-level operations passageway was crammed with enough food to make it completely impassable. Anyone trying to reach the wardroom had to walk through the captain's quarters, through his bathroom to the executive officer's bathroom, and out of the XO's door, emerging to take a right at the first cleared path. Commander Peter J. Grafe was at the helm for this trip. Grafe, the father of six, looked out for his crew, and they knew it. If he wasn't in the con, Grafe was probably playing cribbage in the wardroom, riding an exercise bike he had stashed in the engine room, or sitting with one of his chiefs. Rank didn't matter to him. Parchi did. He believed every minute he was on board that he was at the high point of his career. What was to come after, he once told one of his men, "Just doesn't matter. It's all downhill." As he led his crew out for their Odyssey 82, some of the men were reveling in their special celebrity. Others just reveled. Animal was on board, so dubbed because he delighted in breaking his own record for time lapsed between showers, and because he alternately entertained and tortured his mates with his stink-off contests. Then there was Bumper Car, who had acquired his name because he liked to walk through the sub, bouncing off walls, saying, "Look at me, I'm a bumper car." There was also a quartermaster called Big Bird. He weighed in at more than 300 pounds, and he couldn't move through any of the hatches on board without somebody shouting, "Open, shut." As far as the crew is concerned, the best diversion of all came from one of the youngest officers, Lieutenant Timothy R. Fane. The men saw him as a rag hat, just like them. He sported a goatee and shared their disdain for officer decorum. They targeted Fane's good nature for their most daring pranks. Their favorite was E.B. Greening him, grabbing Fane and mummifying him with the leaf-green duct tape favored by the electric boat company because it could withstand sea pressures. It had been developed to seal up small cracks in equipment, but on Parchy, it was used primarily to bind and gag Fane. On this trip, he would be left green-wrapped for grafe on the wardroom table, and he would be similarly bandaged and left in the tunnel on the way to the reactor compartment as a surprise for the engineer officer. The XO, Timothy W. Oliver, had less patience for the crew's antics, especially after the door to his compartment somehow ended up beneath the engines, then in the wine cellar, a space by the bilges, and on into other hiding places around the boat. "No movies tonight," Oliver would shout, echoing, by all accounts unaware, James Cagney's portrayal of a blowhard supply ship captain in Mr. Roberts. Parchy might have been headed toward a mission more daring than any depicted a couple of years later in The Hunt for Red October, but she was manned by a crew taking its cues from MASH. There was just one moment when everyone on board was certain of their position, and that was when they crossed the equator. In a ceremony that had been repeated on many submarines, first-timers were initiated and humiliated as they paid homage to King Neptune. They were forced to eat a bilious concoction off the king's belly, quite literally the stomach of one of their more experienced mates. There were no such celebrations when Parchy finally entered the Barents. This time her divers were installing a new kind of tap pod. The clamps were gone. Instead, this pod was designed to break away and remain on the sea bottom if the Soviets tried to raise the line for any reason. Other procedures also had been changed since the Soviets found the Okhotsk tap. After Parchy's